Somers to Yonkers, Tarrytown to Portchester.
We've got Westchester covered.
We are Westchester Talk Radio.
Adventure Girl, explore your world.
Live from City Center at White Plains, Westchester Talk Radio presents the 25th edition of Fran's World. This is Jim Cleefield speaking. Fran's World is produced by Shark Creative and made possible by Entergy, Indian Point Energy Center. Hightower, Westchester, your wealth is managed to a fiduciary standard. White Plains Hospital, exceptional every day. Westchester County Office of Economic Development, Robeson, the house that service built, and Accorda Therapeutics, Life Science. Don't forget, please download the Westchester Talk Radio app on iTunes through the App Store at Westchester Talk. You can like us on Facebook at Westchester Talk Radio, and please follow us on Instagram. You'll find us there at Shark Creative. And now the show starring the woman who really loves to talk. She's the world's fastest talking woman. She lives in her world, and we're welcome to it. It's Fran's World. And now, here's your host, Fran Cabo.
Yay! Thank you. We're here live at City Center. Oh, there's a whole bunch of people around. You can't see them, obviously, because it's radio. But anyway, first of all, Jim, happy belated birthday.
Thank you, Fran.
You're welcome. And I'll give you a gift later on. I gave you a gift already. That's good enough. Okay, how you doing, Matt? You doing all right?
We're doing great today.
Look, he gave you a round of applause for that.
It was a delayed reaction.
Yeah, that was a very delayed reaction. Yeah. Anyway, so I'll let you know what I've been, because it's been a month since I've seen you guys. So I've been doing, of course, you know, always my crazy adventures. You know, do you know of the iFly in Yonkers, where you go in and it simulates that you're doing, like, parachuting? Right, exactly.
My niece did it.
Yeah, all right. Well, that makes me feel a lot better.
Yes.
So some little kid did it. So now, all right, you kind of take away the whole thing. All right. Well, you know what? It's probably a different one than I did. No, okay. But anyway, so I was doing that. I did a show the other day for the Knights of Columbus. We sold out, so this is our fifth show that we did, so I was really happy with that. And Sunday, I am actually shooting a zombie movie.
You are?
Yes, and the guy said to me, Fran, we're going to let you play yourself, but, you know, you have to figure out how you're going to kill the zombie. So I said, why can't I just, like, fast talk so the zombie's head explodes? So he said, yeah, I like that. So that's actually what we're going to do. I'm going to talk so fast the zombie's head's going to explode. He's going to die. So I think that'll be a good comic relief in the movie. Maybe it works in real life. I don't know. But I also have another event I'm doing. It's called Mark Your Brand, Saturday, October 26th. It's going to be from noon to 4 p.m. at Mahoney's in Poughkeepsie. And if people want to find out about it, they can go to Hudson Valley Gold Rewards event page. And that's going to be me talking about how a world record mindset can help you accomplish anything, and also talking about the proper way to brand your you know, who you are, because otherwise it's like, what makes you stand out from everybody else? Nothing, unless you brand yourself, and that's what you got to do. So I am very excited because we have three fantastic guests today, Jim. And so our first guest that I'm going to be bringing here is Brad Morse. Now, Brad is a 33-year-old veteran in the tourism business, utilizing ecotourism and outdoor adventures to... Ignore that man. This is like the Wizard of Oz. Ignore that man behind the curtain. All right. Let me start again. Brad Morse is a 33-year-old veteran in the tourism industry, utilizing ecotourism, outdoor adventures to build successful business models around the world. He's the principal partner in several dynamic tourism businesses where he personally has developed the business from the ground up. Some of Brad's businesses he builds are zip lines in Jamaica, which I think I've gone on those, Cantina Island, St. Thomas, New Hampshire, and Hunter Mountain. If you guys have ever gone to Hunter Mountain, it is so cool. He has he has the zip line in Hunter Mountain, which is the tallest and fastest zip line in the East Coast. And we'll be talking more about that later. But anyway, he also has currently a walkway system in the Amazon jungle in Peru, as well as many others. He currently operates, like I said, the Canopy Tour in Hunter, New York, and travels the globe consulting others in design, installation, inspection, training, and the development of tourism products. This guy does a lot of things. He has designed, installed, and tested countless outdoor adventure tourism activities, because, you know, you don't just put that thing up and say, oh, yeah, it looks good. You got to make sure you know somebody, you know, has somebody that knows what he's doing. He has well delivered hundreds of safety-related trainings, written training inspection manuals, as well as conducted hundreds of safety equipment and structure inspections around the world with an outstanding safety track record. Look, he's got a long resume here. You know, I'm going to actually, there's no interview. I'm just going to read his resume. Brad has has also served as expert witness in many legal cases in the industry, with both relenting focus on safety and a militaristic approach to training and dispatching these things together, have proven to serve the clients of more 3,500,000 customers for over three decades. He's spoken in the UN, and we're just so happy to have Brad Morse with us. How are you, Brad?
Thank you, Fran. Glad to be here.
Great. Well, all right. That is quite a resume. So did you ever, when you were a kid, did you say, one day I'm going to grow up and this is going to be my job? Like, how did you come up with this cool job?
No, of course not. But my sister actually is the reason I'm here. She found a job in the paper called a ropes course director. And this is 33 years ago when I was 16. And I went off and got trained on how to do team building and work with kids. And it all kind of took off from there. And I've been doing this ever since. And back then, it was the early days of this industry. And there was only a couple people like myself doing it.
Right.
And allowed me to be a leader in the industry and travel the world and introduce this to everyone.
But now, when you did that, did you have any knowledge of, like, how to do this rope course? Or you just said, oh, that looks like fun. I'll go do it.
I had no idea at all. I knew
nothing.
Idea
at all.
The closest thing I did was build a zip line for my G.I. Joe when I was in, like, third grade or something.
Oh, wow.
But, that's the extent of the knowledge.
Yeah, and that weighs maybe 1 pound as opposed to people who weigh a lot more,
That's right. No, but it was a great adventure along the way, though.
Great. So that was your first project, and that was where. So how did you go then from doing the ropes to, like, what other, led you to doing the type of things that you're doing now?
Sure. What happened for me is at a very young age, I was only 16, and I was out teaching corporate executives how to work together, team building, and all these things kind of gave me a lot of confidence at a very young age that I could do anything. I didn't really know what I was doing, but it showed me that if you get your head screwed on right and you have some level of intelligence, you can pretty much do whatever you want as you can figure it out. And it's kind of been my mantra my whole life,
Say yes and figure it out later, mantra that I live by.
Yeah, exactly. And it works. It truly does. And what you do is you surround yourself with good people who can help you along the way.
Well,
that's the trick.
People don't realize that because, they say you're the sum of the five people that you hang around the most with. Like, if you hang around people who are not doing, let's just eat potato chips on the couch, you're not going to go very far. But if you're surrounding yourself, and I could just imagine you're 16 and you're training these corporate executives, that had to give you, not an ego boost in a bad way, but like give you confidence, like they're trusting me.
Sure.
I only worked with a G.I. Joe doll, if they only knew.
No, that's right. That's right. And actually, the thing that set me off was when I was 19, I got hired by MIT as an instructor to teach the kids at the school how to be more interactive and not overly critical. And so I was going to college in Fitchburg State and then traveling to MIT during the week to be an instructor. And all my fraternity brothers were like, what is going on in this world? But
that you're teaching,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. But it was that actually was a big critical moment for me because I struggle with a learning disability. I have dyslexia and ADD and all kinds of other problems. And so schoolwork never worked well for me. And so for the concept of me to be an instructor at MIT was mind-blowing for me, okay? And,
and gave
me another level of confidence that even though I didn't feel that great in school because I was always, I wasn't a smart kid.
It's not a matter of not being smart. It was because you're doing the traditional way, which
That's
is reading the books, but you had an ability that surpassed doing that type of thing, but you wouldn't have known if
That's
you didn't
correct.
Do this.
Right. I found experiential learning, learning by doing, which had nothing to do with my dyslexia. And as soon as I discovered it, I excelled and took off. And I brought some of my friends with me, too. And a bunch of us in high school were traveling around building ropes courses and stuff. It was really cool. It was back in the 80s and 90s when you could do that sort of thing. Nowadays, you can't do that.
So did you take was there like an engineering class that you took or something to be able to learn how to put these structures up?
No, there was, I took a course with how to run them, but then I apprenticed with a company for several years, building them. But there were no standards. There was just the way we thought safety should be, And
so you were creating the standards.
That's correct. Yeah. Now there's an organization called the ACCT, which is the Association for Challenge Course Technology. But I started before it ever existed, and we helped establish what those standards are today.
I was just going to say, you had to have then been the, kind of almost the foundation for a lot of those principles that you use because your stuff was successful.
Absolutely.
So you have, so the partners you have today, so the businesses that you do, you know, evolved out of the businesses, you know, from when you were young. Now you have partners in the Hunter Mountain?
Yes, I do. Yep.
Okay. But we want to explain what the Hunter Mountain zip line is, because
sure.
It's not part of Hunter Mountain.
No, correct. It's my own business with my partners, and it is, well, it was the fastest zip line tour, longest, highest in North America. I'm not sure it still is anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't actually monitor that.
Right.
But it
That's
was.
That's the PR's department.
Yeah, it was when we established it, and it's wonderful. It's up at Hunter Mountain. We have two zip line tours. Our slogan is From Mild to Wild. Our mild tour is our mid-mountain tour, family-friendly canopy experience, very wonderful time. And then the Skyrider tour is insane.
I've done that, and I want to tell anybody who's listening, if you guys like the slightest bit of like adventure, this is like taking it to the max. I did it with my son for Mother's Day, and I'm always the one that comes up with these ideas. So we went to the top, and we get to the top, and I look, it's like from mountaintop to mountaintop. And I looked at my son, he goes, you wanted to do it. I was like, I didn't say I wasn't going to do it. I just said I'm a little scared.
That's right.
You know?
Well, it's funny. The reason I built the mild tour is when I stood up there to build the wild tour, I was like, this is going to be a problem. Not everyone's going to do this. And so,
oh, so you built the other one.
Then we built
so
the
that,
other
right.
tour as an afterthought, actually. And actually, both are equally successful. And we had a wonderful summer. That's a great fall foliage activity to do. And just a good time.
You know, yeah, well, I look forward. I'm definitely going to do it again.
Yeah.
So now, Brad, tell us how your business evolved and about your business in Jamaica, how that changed your
sure.
whole perspective of life.
Yeah, absolutely. So I went to Jamaica. What I do is I'm a consultant, and I travel the world, and I help design outdoor adventure experiences for people, primarily ecotourism. And I ended up...
Explain, because not everybody might understand what that is. So ecotourism is a way for them to get money into their country.
Well, ecotourism basically means that you have a minimal impact on the attraction or the experience that you're going on.
So you're not polluting.
And, yeah, you're not polluting,
you're not
wearing, and you know, hopefully that it also will have return for the community in a positive way. It's not just like building an amusement park.
Right,
you know,
right.
And so, and usually they tend to be smaller and in more remote locations and things like that. So I went to Jamaica. I was invited by the Minister of Tourism to be his partner and build an attraction there. And all I could think of was, you know, what a great opportunity for me to become a little richer and figure things out. This is great. I'll go to Jamaica. So I went there. I built the attraction. And after a couple of years of running it, I realized the economic impact that my attraction was having in the small, remote mountain town where I employed everybody. And after a while, I was able to look around and see the growth that my business had there. And it just hit me, like the power that I, not the power, but the ability I had with these small businesses and how such a large impact can be made in these people's homes and in their lives. And so it changed me. It really did. I saw that I wasn't just a zipline builder, but I actually was a developer of economic growth in small communities. And it changed everything. And it changed my direction. And it's actually then I built Hunter Mountain. And I built Hunter Mountain with an economic development grant from the state because the community I put it in needed jobs. And I am now the second largest employer in our area and drive over 50,000 visitors to our region. Restaurants have opened up. Hotels have been reestablished during the summertime, all through these efforts. And so that's kind of what I'm about now. And what I'm trying to do with my life is find these places that need the help and use my skills to help them in that way.
See, and that's awesome because a lot of times people always think of money being brought into a community through a store opens up or something. You know, they're not necessarily mm-hmm. thinking, wow, a zip line is going to be bringing that in. And the impact that you had, that's amazing. And plus, it's just really cool to see you've done that type
Absolutely.
Of stuff. So now you're working on a book now about crazy adventures around the world.
Yeah, well, I've been doing this for 33 years, and I have seen a lot and done a lot. Most of my experiences are in third world countries, remote locations.
See, but if, what I want people to understand is, you know, like if somebody goes on an adventure, somebody's already been there and
That's
has
right.
scouted it out. You're the guy going there to scout it out. So you're in the Amazon, seeing the snakes, seeing
oh,
the
yeah.
stuff, clearing the path
oh, yeah. I have
for other
so many
people
stories.
To see.
Yeah.
yeah. Which
yeah.
is awesome.
Yeah, there's, I mean, I've been hunted by leopards. I've been bit by scorpions in the jungle. I've had a huge poisonous spider land on my back. I've had just countless adventures with locals. And that's the part that I love. I mean, truly, I'm exploring jungles and mountain ranges for the very first time with these people, trying to figure out what we can do there. And it's wonderful. And what I try to do is use local supplies, local labor, try not to bring people in. We try to keep all the money whenever possible in that region, because that's part of the whole point.
Yeah, right. That's part of the whole point. That's awesome. Now, I laughed because when you were telling me about this, I actually said to you, do you go on adventures? And you go, what did you tell me? You said, yeah, my idea of a vacation is...
Yeah, drinking a margarita by the pool and
yeah,
relaxing.
Because, because he's like, what are you kidding? I don't need to do this. If I'm doing these crazy things as a living, I don't need to be doing this. Just sit down and relax. And then the other thing that cracked me up is when I was asking you, when you're on an airplane and you're next to somebody, tell me what you tell them. Like, you know how somebody will go, what do you do for a living?
Yeah, I usually tell people I deal with septic waste. And it just ends the conversation. Like right there, they don't want to ask me, because if I tell them what I do, the whole conversation, the whole flight is about me and about what I do, because it's pretty cool and I know that, but I don't really want to talk about myself the whole flight, so I just say that. They don't even want to touch me. They don't even want to shake
exactly.
my hand. Yeah, no, it's all good. I travel a lot. Matter of fact, in the 90s, Bing, the search engine, rated my job the sixth coolest job in the world. And I was rated like, I was called the globe-trotting zipline guy.
Oh, that is awesome. Well, you know that I'm doing the, I'm actually ziplining inside a volcano in Nicaragua, November 19th to the 25th, and it's only the second time in the history of the world that the government is giving us a permit
nice.
To be able to do that. So I'm going to try to talk you into,
All right.
Maybe if your wife Hillary will allow you to come on this adventure, because then I might feel safer, actually. Wait a minute, that zip line's not good. You're going to fall in the lava bed. No, not a good idea. So,
I am a good person to bring on that trip.
Definitely. Yeah. So we know about your unusual job. What's your next project that you're working on? Or the local projects, the local project is Hunter Mountain. So at least, So tell people where it is.
Yeah, well, right now, Hunter Mountain, the zip line tour there, again, is located up at Hunter. But right now I'm working in Peru. And I'm about to work on the longest canopy walkway in the Amazon, or possibly in the world. And I just came back, and I'm heading back in a couple weeks, and hopefully we'll open. And it, again, is to help a group of small eco lodges in the middle of nowhere blossom and help that economy grow. That's why we're doing it.
Right, because then people hear that and they're like, that's cool, I want to do it.
That's right.
People, tourism from, people from all over the world, like me, the people, the crazy people, I got to do that. So, because that type of thing. But just so people know, for the local people, but this does air, worldwide, but if you want to find out about the Hunter Mountain one, you go to Zipline New York, you spell it out, don't be lazy and abbreviate, okay? So Zipline, N-E-W-Y-O-R, okay, in case you don't know how to spell, Zipline New York, and that is where you do that. But if you want to get in touch with Brad personally, you go to his website, which is ziplinebuilders.com. Ziplinebuilders.com. And I don't know, maybe you have a place that you say, hey, I need this guy to come and build something for me. That'll be really cool. And Canopy Tours, Zipline and Walkways is the name of the company. But like I said again, you go to Brad at ziplinebuilders.com, but check out the Hunter Mountain. That is just real cool. Just even just go and look at the website, ziplinenewyork.com. Anyway, Brad Morris, thank you so much for coming here. I His wife, I have to do mention this, his wife Hillary is here also, and they're with their dog, so they're all patiently waiting. And I am going to be actually working with Hillary on April 18th at the school doing a talk there. So your family's just like very talented.
Well, thank you. I think so too.
And even the dog. The dog's over there juggling. Nobody could see it, but the dog's juggling. See, this is why people have to be here live. You know, he's juggling melons from Shoprite. So anyway, we'll see. Thank you so much for coming on. And this is Fran Capo from Fran's World. We'll be right back on Fran's World from City Center Live in a few minutes.
At Indian Point, we've helped power Westchester and New York City for about 4 decades. Recently, as part of an agreement with New York State, we are working toward an early and orderly shutdown of the facility by 2021. Until then, we'll continue safely generating about 25% of the reliable, round-the-clock electricity that powers the city and Westchester, all with virtually no greenhouse gas emissions. Safety is, as it always has been, the top priority for everyone at the plant. We will continue to keep Indian Point fully staffed, and full-time inspectors from the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission will monitor our daily operations. We'll also continue to play an important role in our community as a taxpayer and active participant in local charities. Indian Point Energy Center is still working for you, and it's our honor to continue to serve the people of New York. If you have questions about our ongoing operations, please visit safesecurevital.com.
News, trends, and more.
No one knows Westchester County better than we do.
We are Westchester Talk Radio.
Adventure Girl, explore your world.
And we're back. You're listening to Fran's World, live from City Center, produced by Shark Creative and made possible by Entergy Indian Point Energy Center, Lapolis Electric, electrical contractor, Genesis Exhibits, trade show displays, Wartburg Home Healthcare and Rehabilitation Center, Facelifts Remodeling, Feature Fine Paints of Europe, and the White Plains YMCA. Remember YMCA? Okay, there we go. Anyway, continuing the show right here, I have another fantastic guest with me, and his name is Lou Dorio. He's retired after a 20-year decorated profession as a local Westchester, New York Suburban Police Department. His career included the ranks of patrolman, sergeant, lieutenant, captain, and finally, he was chief of police. He attended many training schools, including Executive Development Academy at the FBI and Quantico, thank you very much, can't speak, Quantico, Virginia. Lewis's certifications include firearms, general topics, master's instructor. Lewis trained all levels of law enforcement officers in a variety of topics. He is a Vietnam veteran, thank you very much, having served in the U.S. Navy aboard the USS Orkney in the Gulf of Tonkin, Vietnam. Boy, I'm probably butchering these names, sorry about that. Lewis has been adjunct professor of criminal justice at several Westchester County colleges and universities, including Westchester Community College. His most recent position, his education includes associate's, bachelor's, master's degree in criminal justice. He lives right here in Westchester County, and he's married with 2 beautiful grown daughters and 5 grandchildren. Oh my gosh, that's a handful just in itself. His latest endeavor, however, is why he is here. He has written a book called Murder Finds the Suburbs. And why is this important? Because it's based on one of his real life investigations. Please welcome Lou Dorio. Hey, Lou, how are you doing?
How are you?
I'm doing great. Now, first of all, thank you for your service in both the police department and in the military.
Thank you.
Yeah, because I always feel like you're the guys who run in the direction of where everybody else is running the other way. It's like, oh, my gosh, wait, gun. Okay, we're going to run there. So I always thank you guys for that. So we know where you grew up. You grew up in Westchester?
White Plains. I grew up right here in White Plains.
And this is where you went to school?
Went to school here, graduated from White Plains High School. Mm-hmm. My wife and I graduated together.
And by the way, his wife is here. She's actually right here because he said, I came early to do your show. She's off shopping. So just to get a little bit of your past, did you go straight from school into the military in Vietnam?
I did. I joined the Navy at 17 years old. It was the only branch that would take you under 18.
Oh, really?
I had to have my parents' signature. They called it the Kitty Cruise program. If you went in when you were 17, you got out the day before your 21st birthday. So I went in right after high school, and I stayed in there for a little over 3 years because it got close to my 21st birthday. And then I retired from there. And that's getting out of the Navy. Oh, by the way, the name of the ship is the USS Oriskany.
Thank you, Oriskany.
I watched them on the Learning Channel sinking my ship to make it a coral reef off the coast of Pensacola, Florida.
How did that feel, seeing that?
That felt odd because that was my home for a while. So to watch them sinking it, that wasn't a good feeling. But it was a good experience. The Navy taught me a lot about discipline, which I probably needed before I went in.
Doesn't every 16-year-old boy? Okay.
But as I was being separated from the service in San Francisco, we had a talk by a CHIPS officer, California Highway Patrol, mm-hmm. and they were trying to recruit people getting out of the service. And I went over to the gentleman who was about 6'6". And I looked up at him, and I said, that sounds like something interesting I might be interested in. He says, how tall are you, boy? I said, 5'8". He said, I'm sorry, your heart requirement's 6 foot. So
really?
I left, and I came home, and I checked with White Plains. Theirs was 5'10", so I didn't think it was in the cards. But then I found out Towns and Villages was 5'8", and that's when I started.
So you just had to go wherever they accepted your height.
Yeah. In other words, I was tall enough to go into service, but I wasn't tall enough to be a police officer.
Oh, no, we could give him a gun, and we could let him go aboard, and he could fight and everything. But, no, those few inches, no way.
No.
Yeah, right. So something inside of you has always made you want to be able to protect people and serve people.
I always had an interest in law enforcement. I had a very good relationship growing up in White Plains with the officers in White Plains, maybe because I never got in serious trouble, but it was something that always interested me. And like you said, it's the same mentality as the military.
Right.
Wanting to do something. And I tell my students, and I told my officers when I worked, you have to go into police work with the right attitude for the right reason. You know, going in to help someone, benefits is nice, salary is nice, but you have to go in with the right reason.
And the right reason being?
To help people.
To help people, not because you think, oh, good, I can only work for 20 years and then do it, because that's not going to work. You'll be over there hiding around the corner when something's happening if you're not going in with the right.
It'll be a long 20 years if that's why you went in.
Right. Yes. And I believe any job, you really kind of have to love what you do. Otherwise, life is miserable because the whole time you're like, God, I only have 10 more years. I only have 5 more years. It's like, this is your life. Do something you love.
Exactly.
You know? Now, let's get to this. I do want to ask one other question, because I've always been fascinated with this. Because I obviously am not doing what you do. I do these crazy adventures that people always are like, are you scared? And they go, oh, I can't believe you don't have any fear. I go, wait, who said I don't have any fear? I have fear, but I've chosen that I'm going to do it anyway. So I was just curious, the mindset. Obviously, you get trained as a military person and as a police officer. But does the training, like, somehow knock the fear out of you? Or does it, like, you still fearful, but you've been trained so much, you automatically know how to respond?
You always have to have the fear in your mind. Because when you get too comfortable, then you get complacent and you let your guard down.
Yeah.
So if you always realize that something can happen at any given time and prepare yourself by using the training you had, by using the equipment that they've given you, bulletproof vest and so forth, then you're prepared for what you're doing. There was one of my shipmates when I was in the service before we went over to Vietnam, and he used to always pull up to the ship on a motorcycle. And one day we were looking over the ship, and we saw him pull up in a car. And when he came up, we said, where's your motorcycle? He said, I got rid of it. And we said, how come? He goes, I'm not afraid of it anymore. So he lost the fear of crashing, and he figured, I'm going to get too sloppy, and he got rid of the motorcycle.
Wow, that's interesting perspective, but that makes sense. You know, it's like, and also people don't realize, a lot of people say, oh, you know, they shouldn't have done this, people shouldn't do this, and I'm always like, put yourself in that position. You know, I've been held up at gunpoint. Three times, unfortunately. And, didn't live in the best neighborhood, obviously. But, no, one time I was at a supermarket and I got held up, you know, and the guy had a sawed-off shotgun. And he asked me to lay down on the floor. And I am not a fashion person, so I don't care about this stuff. And I said to him, no, I can't do it. I have new pants on. And I'm thinking, what am I saying? The guy has a gun. You know, and so he I said, just calm down. And so I figured he wanted all the money from the drawer. I said, there's all the quarters and everything. And I gave him the quarters because I thought it would weigh him down when he ran. And when the police officer, they came, they said, why did he take the boxes of quarters? I'm like, I don't know. He just took those boxes because I was thinking it'll make him harder for him to get away. But let's go into now, let's go to your book. Now, you wrote this book, which is called Murder Finds the Suburbs. And this was based on an actual case that you did. So set it up for us.
Okay, I was on the police department at the time for 7 years. I was a patrol officer. We used to call them patrolmen, but we got politically correct and would say patrol officer after a while because we had a lot more women coming into the service. And the chief had put me into the detective division, not as a detective, but as a patrolman on a temporary assignment. And he put me in there on a Monday. And Thursday of that week, the lieutenant and I were the only two working back there in the detective division. And he said, grab the camera. We got a case across the street from the local high school. So we went out there, and what we had was two girls dumped in trash bags across the street from our high school. So as we're doing the investigation, the lieutenant turned to me and he said, it's your case, kid. So my initial reaction was, be careful what you wish for. You just might actually get it. But it became a case that I was able to do everything. See, in local departments, and I think I've spoken to you before about it, the majority of police departments in the United States, about 80%, have less than 25 police officers.
Which is amazing when you think about how little that is with so many people.
Because everybody compares to New York City, which has got 38,000 people. So what we are is what we consider ourselves as generalists. So as I was doing this homicide investigation, I also had burglaries I was investigating, whereas you'd take a larger department, they have a homicide division. That's all they do is homicides. So I had to go watch the autopsies, interview people, try and...
You had to do every aspect of the case where a larger department normally would say, okay, we're going to send these specialists here, these specialists. You were the guy.
Correct. And so it was an interesting case. We went through the case. It took a while. We cultivated witnesses. We cultivated suspects. I don't want to give away too much of the
book. Right, because you want people to read the book, yeah.
We had a very successful conclusion to the case, which gave me both personal and professional satisfaction.
So let me ask you something, though. Why did this case affect you more than a lot of the other cases that you had to deal with? Because it was your first, or what?
That was part of it. You know, I had been on dead body cases before, not as the investigator.
And we're not talking
detective.
About people who are just boring. Yeah.
No. Okay. But what made this one stick in my mind was because we were getting criticism from within our own department that we'll never find out who they are, and when we did, you'll never find out who did it, and so forth. So we had that
as far as our own people. Right.
Yeah. But what gave me a personal connection to this one were these were two young ladies who were 15 and 20 years of age, and here I had two daughters at home. So, you know, I put myself in the place of the families of these two young girls. And I said they deserve to know exactly what happened to their daughters.
Right.
And that was a motivating factor because
almost like whenever you have something like that, you do have a tendency in your head to go, gosh, if this was my kid or if this was my pet or if this was my job, you know what I mean? Like you could do the comparison and even though you don't like the outcome, sometimes that closure of knowing at least what happened or justice was served, it's not going to bring the person back, but at least you feel like, wow, I now understand what happened.
I think the defining moment was seeing these two young girls lying on the stainless steel tables in the morgue. You know, that's something that you look at it and you say, there but for the grace of God goes my children. You know?
Right. Now, you say in the book, without giving too much away, you had to make some very hairy decisions. In hindsight, would you put yourself in those same situations?
Probably. I'm probably dumb enough to do it again. You know, my wife lived through this case with me, and she was my inspiration for writing the book, and she was my first editor, and it made it easy because she lived it. But even after the book was out and she actually sat down and read it, she said, I didn't realize some of the dumb stuff you did. You know,
she's like, you only do that at home. What, you're doing that at work too?
And one of my daughter's friends said, what was your dad thinking? Did he not remember that he had two daughters at home? You get so involved in it, you really don't think about, what am I doing here? The one aspect of the case that I did think, what am I doing, was when we went to arrest the first individual, and we had a warrant to go in without knocking. But the lieutenant from the 50th Precinct, who was doing our emergency services backup, said, why don't we not kick the door down at 2 o'clock in the morning and cause a firefight, because we figure there's guns inside there. And he said, is there anybody here who this man has seen before? Well, I happen to be the only one in the group the guy had seen. So I raised my hand like a kid in school. Yeah, me. And he said, why don't we do this? We'll wait until about 7 o'clock in the morning, and you go knock on the door. And when he opens the door, get out of the way, because we'll come running through. So I walk up to the door, and here I'm standing with my Izod jacket on over my bulletproof vest. And I'm getting ready to knock on the door, and I said to myself, are you really doing what you think you're doing here? So I went to hit the door. I knocked on the door, but the door was ajar. And it started to open, and sure enough, I had four Kevlar-clad emergency service guys coming over my shoulder and busting in. The guy wasn't in there. We arrested him out on the street. We came outside, and I said, there he is. He's walking down the street with a cup of coffee and a newspaper. But as I was standing at that door, that's one of
your
the things
heart must
that
have been pounding, going, what am I doing?
What a dumb thing to do. But, hey, what the hell, I'd do it again.
I have a question, actually. With all the years you spent in law enforcement, what was probably the scariest moment for you, if there was one that you had to say was probably the absolute, you know, worst one?
I would not say scariest moment, but there were times that it was a very emotionally draining job when you had to do things like notify someone their child was killed in an accident or something of that nature. It wasn't so much the fear as it was the realization that this is real. And that was probably the impetus behind the book, is that these things happen everywhere. It's not just New York City. It's not just the big cities. It happens in the suburbs. In fact, it's not in the book, but 11 days after we found these bodies, we had our second building in town blown up by a terrorist group.
Oh, wow.
An IBM facility. Who was opposed to IBM's involvement in South Africa. So those things, what used to bother me is, and it still does, when people say, that's not supposed to happen here, which implies that it is supposed to happen somewhere. I mean, I can understand if you say it doesn't usually happen here. But
right,
to
but
say
not,
it does,
it's not,
not supposed
right, like
to,
your town is immune from it, and it can't be. And that's kind of reminds me of what you said about your friend with the motorcycle. Like he said, when you lose the fear, when you have the thing, like nothing will ever happen in this town. I can leave my door open. I can leave my, and you get that attitude, you know, and then all of a sudden your car is robbed or something happens, and you're like, well, it's not supposed to happen here. Right. Well, who said, where's that sign that says to the robber's not supposed to be here?
Right. Unfortunately, the police officers tend to have the same mentality when they go to a call. We got a lot of burglar alarms in our town. Mm-hmm. It's a wealthy community, and property crimes were the majority of our crimes. And people would walk up to the front door on a burglar alarm, police officers, and knock on the door, like the burglar's going to answer the door, you know?
Yeah, right.
We would tell them, treat every alarm as though it's a real burglary until you prove otherwise. Because to do less, you're putting yourself in a very, very bad situation.
And people don't think. That's the problem. Is
they
that
don't
people
think.
Do that. So I don't want to give any, you know, away from the book, but I will mention this. I notice sometimes, like, if you go into a police station, the computers are not updated. And a lot of the stuff is, like, outdated material. Why? What's the problem about having, you know, high-tech stuff for you guys?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Police departments buy things, and this became very real to me when I made chief and I was in charge of a budget that I had to buy stuff. We buy things. We tend to buy things on low bid.
Okay.
We don't go high.
So it's the big lots of police.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's how you save money. If you're buying from the state contract on police cars, you know, everybody's buying from that car rather than you going to a car dealership and saying, oh, yeah, I would like that car over there. That'd be a nice police car. So back then, it wasn't because we couldn't afford the technology. It wasn't out. you know, I'm doing a surveillance on an apartment. I don't have a cell phone. I don't have a camera. You know, so I'm standing out there going, gee, if I get in trouble, what am I getting? Because I was undercover.
Yeah,
but
you're
going to
start screaming? Yeah, I mean, you know.
That would have done a lot of good in the Bronx.
Yeah, right. But, they'd be, oh, just another person having fun.
But I was close to Montefiore Hospital, so I would have been okay.
I could drag myself to there.
But it's not that the police departments don't want the best equipment. And they are getting more and more sophisticated with equipment that they have, making it easier to do their job.
For you guys, that's what I'm always thinking. Like, make it easier for them to do their jobs. Don't make it where, you know, they have to go, oh, let me pull out this typewriter, you know. So now I just wanted, because we only have a few minutes left, I just want to find out, where can people get your book?
The book is available on Amazon, both as print and Kindle. It's available in Barnes & Noble. It's currently on sale in Pleasantville Bookstore, which is called the Village Bookstore in Pleasantville, New York. Which is where I live. It's available in Chappaqua, in Scatterbooks is the name of the bookstore.
So those are the brick and mortar places, but if somebody listening wanted to order it online, they could go to www.amazon.com, which makes sense, right? You go to amazon.com/author, and then you remember, who's the author? Louis Dorio, D-O-R-I-O. So www.amazon.com/author/Louis Dorio. Or if anybody has questions, I know that they could go to you at www.goodreads.com. And maybe you might want to have Louis come and talk at your event, you know, about the case and other things about his book. He's obviously, you could see, he has no problem talking. And, you know, the book is very good. I found it very fascinating. I read it in like one sitting. And then, of course, I was taking my notes and I'm like, oh, I can't say this. I don't want to give it away. But I was like, so many curious things. I was like, oh, should I ask him about the psychic? But I'm not going to say it because we're running out of time and you people have to read it to find out about that. But anyway, Louis, it's a pleasure having you here. Thank you very much. The book is fantastic. It's called Murder Finds the Suburbs. And again, the author is Louis, L-O-U. L-O-U-I-S. I always do this in case people don't know how to spell. L-O-U-I-S Dorio. D-O-R-I-O. Okay? Louis Dorio. And again, you could go to amazon.com/author/Louis Dorio. Check out his book, Murder Finds the Suburbs. This is Fran Capo on Fran's World, and we'll be right back in a few minutes with our next guest.
Pasquale.
Pasquale Ristorante is the perfect dining experience. Your favorite Italian comfort food, plus the comforts of home away from home. Pasquale Ristorante has been treating you like family for nearly 20 years. And if you need catering, Pasquale will take care of it. Pasquale Ristorante, bringing family, friends, and food together.
Pasquale Ristorante treats you just like family. Pasquale Ristorante, an Italian specialty.
Pasquale Ristorante, 2 Putnam Avenue in Port Chester.
Knows Westchester County better than we do.
We are Westchester Talk Radio.
Adventure Girl, explore your world.
This is Fran Capo, and we're back. Fran's World, live at City Center. And my next guest, actually, if you guys have been listening for a while, you will know, because he is a repeat guest, because we loved him so much, we had him back. He's been on our show before. To refresh your memory, Richard Heumann is a lyricist for the band American Nomads, which is American Roots band that did a song tribute for Woodstock anniversary. But he is also a neo-conceptual artist, having had many national and international gallery and museum exhibitions. He's also represented the United States. Oh boy, I'm going to be messing up these names. In Karachi Biennale, and has been in Venice Biennale as well. A documentary of his work called Tiger Horse will be out shortly. But he's here today because of this, because his latest show just opened last night, Thursday, September 26th, called Ascension, and it was at the Highline 9 Gallery at 507 West 27th Street in New York City. It's a large-scale augmented reality piece of art that originally premiered at the 2017 Venice Biennale at Palazzo Mora in Venice, Italy. Then it went on to Seoul, Korea, and now it's in New York. So I want to find all about, and he's going to explain what augmented reality is in case you guys don't understand. So first, congratulations, Richard, head of the show last night.
Really well attended, really big opening. And after the opening, I brought everybody up to the High Line. And if people don't know, the High Line runs on the west side of Manhattan from 34th Street all the way down to Gansford Street. And I installed Ascension on the High Line. So you can walk along the High Line and through your phone, augmented reality is, it's not like virtual reality where you have to have like a headset. You could actually look at it on your phone and you hold it up and you can see my work floating in the sky above New York City.
It's cool because I was asking my son to explain the difference. And just like you said, he said when you do virtual reality, you put something on your eyes and yes. You are transported into their world. In correct. Augmented reality, you're in your world, but you hold up your phone or iPad and your world becomes transformed through what the artist put up.
That's exactly what it is. That is correct. And augmented reality is becoming bigger now. Apple has actually launched something called ART, which is an augmented reality art thing, the same way the company I'm working with, the company called Airy. And they sponsored my event at the Venice Biennale in 2017. So I've been working with them for a couple of years now. Like you said, we did the Venice Biennale. Then I went on to Korea. And then I put a piece. I had a crew with me over the DMZ between North and South Korea. So I was up there for a month in Korea. And living at the DMZ, we're up there for a week. We're the only Americans allowed in the section we were in. We had to actually give up our passports to be there.
Wow.
And we lived there for about a week filming and putting my work up between the two countries.
Yeah, and it's awesome because you would tell me, I performed at the DMZ Zone as a stand-up doing a tour for Armed Forces Entertainment, so I know how heavily guarded that area is to the point that they actually say, don't stand too close to the door. They can grab you and bring you in there.
It's a misnomer because it's called like the DMZ is the demilitarized zone and it's that most heavily militarized zone on the planet.
Exactly. That is so funny that you say it because it's true. You go, no, it is not demilitarized. If anything, it's like everywhere you turn, there is somebody, that's watching, from both sides. And
there's also tons of landmines there. They're like, at one point, there were like 4 million landmines. I still think there's close to a million unaccounted for. So there were places where we were that you couldn't leave a particular area because they hadn't been swept from mines. So they would clear 2-3 acres at a certain point, and then you couldn't go beyond that. And to this day, farmers still end up losing legs and because we just don't know where they are.
The guy that took us there actually said that. He goes, I know this sounds crazy, but where you're standing right now is one of the most dangerous places in the world because there's still all those things that are not detonated.
So you don't know.
But let's get, which it's amazing that you were there and you said that you went into tunnels and, all these things.
Oh, yeah, we climbed down. They're called tunnels of aggression. And I've actually been into three of them now. They literally go like a mile under the ground. I think there's five or six of them. And running the whole length of the DMZ, the 38th parallel, and I've been down into them. And you go like a mile underground and you go right to the North Korean border underground. It's actually really claustrophobic. And, I'm a 6-foot-tall American. And when they were built in the 50s, they're much shorter. So you wear a hard hat, but I bang my head many times.
You had to probably be on like your hands and knees crawling.
Basically.
Yeah, right. It's like, wait a minute. No. I'm too tall. But,
exactly.
Oh, my. Yeah. So, but I know you love crazy adventures. And just like my first guest, Brad Morris, we were talking about that you might be coming to the volcano adventure also, but we'll be talking about that later.
Yeah.
Now I just want so people understand, first of all, your show is running for how long? Or was it just last night?
About a month. month. I think it's up for about a month. It opened last night, and as I say, it's on the High Line. It's at Highline 9 Gallery, and then you can get the information from Highline 9 Gallery and then walk the High Line and see the entire show. And it's up, I think it's most of the shows like this are for a month at a time.
Oh, that's awesome. So basically, just so people understand kind of a little bit of what they're going to be seeing, if it's the same one, this one consists of 12 imaginary constellations that you created, suspended in the sky over New York City, and you created it, and each of the characters that are there, like the two-headed dogs of war, represent the great wars, World War I and World War II, and there's hidden celebrities in there, like the Blue Moon Kind, which equals Elvis Presley, and Tragic Queen equals Marilyn Monroe. But are you narrating it? Has people see it?
No, as an art piece, I mean, there's a narrative to it, of course, but it's not a running narrative like that. So basically what it is, in the constellations that we look at now in the sky, the actual ones, were from 3,000 years ago, you know, like Greek mythology. And I just created basically a modern mythology using, like, highlights and pop stars of the 20th century to create these things. And they're hidden, and it doesn't look like any of those people. You know, the Great Wars is a Doberman picture, and a German Shepherd tied together with the body of a beagle. So this kind of, it's very like metaphoric in shape and design is what it is.
Right.
It's an art piece.
But it's just like when someone does music and then they're singing about someone and someone's like, oh, I think they're singing about this one or this one, and the artist knows who it's about. And
right.
And so, but just because I happened to read up on you, I knew the little insides. So let me ask you, can this only be seen at night?
No, you can see it anytime, 24 hours a day.
Oh, so the day, because it said 6 to 9, that was just your launch.
That was the opening last night, yes. That was the opening. That's the standard time in New York, like a Thursday night, 6 to 8 o'clock. That's what we did. But you can go anytime on the High Line and view the piece.
Wow. And now, I know this sounds crazy, but because I've never seen augmented reality, so like you're holding your cell phone up or your iPad,
yes,
and a bird flies through, does it look like the bird flies through your constellation?
Yeah. It places itself in the real world. That's exactly what happens. And you'll be seeing augmented reality a lot more. I'm not an augmented reality artist. I really am a conceptual artist. Like you mentioned the Karachi Biennale. I was in Karachi and Islamabad 2 years ago. And the piece I created there was a real tangible piece that was 60 feet long by 40 feet wide. It was a massive sculpture that I built there in Pakistan. So, I mean, I'm a conceptually based artist, and this is just a new medium. This is just like when the invention of photography came around in the 1860s, I'm just utilizing.
You dabble in it,
so.
Right. You're
exactly.
let me try this and see, but your main thing is, now what is the neo in front of conceptual art mean?
Well, it's a tough thing because if you're going to put like a moniker on something, conceptualism actually is a historical point in time. In the art world, it's like Joseph Kosuth. It's the early 1960s that works with type and ideas like that. So neoconceptualism is, again, it's what people have called me. It's a moniker. It's where the idea is as important as the work itself.
Cool.
You know, there are paintings that are just about the painting, but then for me, it's about
the story behind, right?
What is a frame and all stuff like that. Yes.
Cool. Now we only have a few more minutes, but I do want to say you also have a documentary coming out about the piece called The Tiger Horse that you placed at the DMZ zone between North and South Korea, which we were talking about before. So is there do you have a date when that documentary is coming out?
Well, we're editing it out. Funny enough, you say about the tunnels, because I just looked at the tunnel sequence this morning. You know what it's like when you're filming something. We were out there for a month, but we had been filming pre-going to Korea for about a couple months. But you film for like 3 months, and then you edit for 3 years.
Yep,
right?
Totally.
Yeah, my God. I mean, I live in Brooklyn. I have a house in Woodstock, New York, and we were just up there last week, working and editing and, stuff like that. So it's just like you have to shut the world out and then just go to it is what happens.
Definitely.
We're hoping for beginning of 2020. That's what we're hoping for.
Well, then we'll have to have you on again so you could talk about your documentary.
I think we're going to premiere at the MoMA, so definitely I would love to come on and talk to you about it.
That would be
awesome.
It's
an interesting story because, you know, you and I have talked privately off air.
Right.
But we had some crazy things happen while we were there. You know, like it was exciting.
And that's the thing that's going to be, and that's the stuff that you're going to be, well, we don't want to give it away too much because you want people to see the documentary. You also have a TV show that might be coming out called Sleep, and we might be doing this. I'm not going to tease it too much, except that Richard, myself, and maybe even Brad, my first guest, might all be going to Nicaragua to sleep inside a volcano. It's only the second time in history that government around anywhere in the world has allowed people to do this. So we'll be talking about that. But again,
the TV show thing we're talking about, and we won't go into too much. But yes, in January, we're up in the Arctic Circle. We were above Kukla, which is on the Tornio River, above the Gulf of Bothnia, you know, 27, 30 below zero, dark 24 hours a day. And we were filming up there, and we worked our way down to Tampere and eventually Helsinki. I was back three times since then.
Wow.
And so, yeah, like you, I like doing crazy things like that.
Yeah. That's why we get along so well.
Exactly.
So anyway, guys, we just want to reiterate here, if you want to see Richard's show, Richard Human, H-U-M-A-N-N. His show's name is called Ascension. And you could go to the Highline. You go to, the gallery is at 507 West 27th Street. And Richard, where again can they purchase tickets?
It's free.
Oh, it's free.
Totally free. Unless it's a museum, museums cost money. A gallery is free. You can just go there, get information, walk up and see it. And everybody there's many, many docents there and people that can help you figure out how to do this. They're very, very helpful.
Oh, my God. So, guys, when you're in Manhattan, this is an awesome thing to do. Instead of just walking around and staring at your feet, look up at the sky and you know, and take you have your phone on you anyway, stick it up there and see the fantastic thing that Richard Hume has done. Thank you, Richard. If you want to check out him, you could go to his website, which is Richard, RichardHumann, two N's, remember, human.com. Thank you so much for having the show. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And
you're the best. You're the best.
Thank you, guys. I love you. All right. See you. Thanks for... Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Thanks, everybody, for listening to Fran's World. And I want to thank, of course, as always, we have Matt, my fantastic engineer.
Thank you, Fran.
And we have Jim.
Thank you, Fran.
I love these guys. And, of course, Andrew, who is the creator. He's not here right now. He walked away. Where is he? Where is Andrew? But we're saying it's produced by Shark Creative, which basically is Andrew. Okay. Andrew has the whole company, does this whole thing. Anyway, we will be back the last Friday of October, so right before Halloween. And, guys, if you're thinking of something, instead of just getting a treat for people, you can get them a cool treat. You can buy my book, New York Myths and Legends, which is in Barnes & Noble and all the bookstores now, or just go to FranCapo.com. And don't forget to download our app, which is...
Okay, that's WestchesterTalkRadio.com. That's the Westchester Talk Radio app on iTunes at Westchester Talk. And, of course, you can go to Instagram, that's Shark Creative also.
There you go. Thank you very much, guys. We'll see
Shark Creative.
Thank you, listener. Yes, Shark Creative is the company you think of for on-hold messages. If you want to hear how it helps, you can call Mercedes-Benz of New Rochelle, Durante Rentals, Michael Labriola Inc., Oak Ridge Staffing, Emma's Ale House, Northeast Environmental, or just go to sharkcreative.com and listen there. Meanwhile, we've expanded our services as your all-audio resource. On-hold messages, of course, production and placement of radio campaigns on the Pete and others too, and now we also have our very own internet radio station, Westchester Talk Radio. Look for us on Facebook at Westchester Talk. Have us come out to your next event, help you capture audio from your sponsors, associates, friends, bite into that first impression with Shark Creative. Everything audio. It just sounds better.
Shark Creative.